When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
And welcome to the New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Raditya from Kyushu University, and today we are joined by three very special guests, Dr. Erica Pafelli, Dr. Fabio Rambelli, and Dr. Andrea Castiglioni, to discuss their most recent edited volume, The Bloomsbury Handbook of Japanese Religions. Dr. Erica Pafelli is Professor of Japanese Studies at the University of Manchester. Dr. Fabio Rambelli is professor at UC Santa Barbara, and Dr. Andrea Castiglioni is a lecturer at Nagoya City University. Before we get into the book, perhaps we can start with a little self-introductions for our listeners who may not be familiar with you or your work. Dr. Pafelli, do you want to go ahead and start?
Sure. Hello, everybody. I'm Erica Pafelli, and I've been working at the University of Manchester since 2013. And my main area of interest is religion in contemporary Japan, in particular a group that developed after the 1970s. So I've been working on the so-called new religions, issue about media and religion, violence, and more recently about Buddhism and emotions.
Great, thank you. Dr. Rambelli, do you want to go next?
Yeah, with pleasure. So hello, everyone. This is Fabio Rambelli. I'm a professor at the University of California, Santa Barbara. I work mainly on pre-modern Japanese religion, like medieval and early modern period. I've been doing some work on the semiotics of Buddhism, on issues of materiality in Buddhism. I've been working on the role of the sea in pre-modern Japanese religiosity. And currently, I'm working on a project on religion and music, special focus on Gagaku.
Okay, thank you. Dr. Castiglioni, please go ahead.
Hi, everybody. I'm Andrea Castiglioni. I'm teaching Japanese religions at Nagoya City University. And my research field is Shugendo, specifically Edo period Shugendo. I made research on Yudono Shugendo, which is a sacred mountains in northern Japan. And recently, I also focused on the relationship between Japanese religion and animality in pre-modern Japan.
Great. Thank you. I think this book is an amazing resource for students and scholars alike. But sort of before we jump into the book, can you perhaps share some of the processes that led to the creation of this book? How did this project begin?
Fabio, shall I start and then you can pick up?
Sure, yeah.
I think the conversation started quite a few years ago, where Bloomsbury wanted a handbook to be produced. And I think Fabio and I were contacted, or maybe Fabio was contacted first, I don't remember exactly. Yeah. And we started discussing that it would have been good to have two people working on it with different period of expertise. So Fabio working more on the pre-modern period and I and myself working more on the contemporary. But we also decided from the very beginning that it was a really too big task for two people to do a handbook, and then that we wanted this to be a collaborative project, so to have other people involved. We make things more interesting, but also more complicated, of course. The other thing we wanted to discuss from the beginning with the publisher was that we didn't want to reproduce a kind of handbook that similar to the very good one that are already available. So we wanted to do something different, try to look also what is was not yet explored in the scholarship. So we wanted to do something that were more similar to a key terms that just a handbook in a sense, mainly because we thought that what was already available was already good. So there was not really any need to replicate something that was already available. Fabio, did I report it correctly?
Oh, yes. Yeah, no, that is pretty much it. I think I was contacted first and I thought about it for a while and then I thought that by myself it was impossible. So then I started talking to with Erica, as pretty much, you know, she said. And then later we were able to add Andrea also to the project. The idea of having a different type of handbook is pretty much what Erica just said, right? That normally handbooks are basically maps of the field as it is now, with some historical background, but mostly they work on established scholarship. So you have Buddhism, Shinto, you have all these traditional divisions. We decided to get rid of that. And focus instead, like Erica said, pretty much on what authors see, where authors see their field going in the next few years. So it will be a map of possible future research rather than what already exists. I mean, that would be the contribution of this particular handbook that we just put out.
I see. Thank you. So now that we're sort of in a topic of sort of this, sort of having a different sort of handbook, I want to sort of talk about the structure of this book, right? And this is sort of a unique aspect of sort of this specific handbook compared to some of the other ones, in the sense that they are sort of a collection of short essays instead of, your typical sort of chapters. So I was wondering if you could tell us some of the reasons in sort of choosing this particular structure instead of, your sort of the typical sort of longer chapters that you'd find in other handbooks. What are sort of the useful things that you can do with sort of, short essays, and what are some of the difficulties that you might find in sort of choosing this particular structure?
So the idea, again, traditional handbooks are geared, directed mostly towards graduate students and professors in the field. And scholars, and so we decided to try to expand the audience, and by writing shorter essays on specific topics, we were hoping that we would give suggestions to undergraduates as well, who are interested in Japanese religions, but they can find a whole lot of topics that are available out there, and also that would intersect with other aspects of the humanities. So that was the main idea behind the structure of the handbook. The other thing is that there are a lot of topics that need to be covered rather than like larger entries on specific religious traditions and their articulations. So we decided to fragment the handbook in this way. Erica and Andrea, perhaps?
Yes, that was. There were some practical reasons, as Fabio said, that with having shorter focus chapter, we could fit more topic in the handbook. But the idea was also, as he was saying, to provide some hints, some ideas about some of the topics that then undergraduate or postgraduate or even researcher can started having an idea of what's going on in a specific field and then move forward. So it was the idea to provide some sort of initial preliminary overview and also indication of possible avenue for further studies in this short chapter. And we thought the shorter chapter worked better for this kind of project we had in mind. Andrea, do you want to add anything to this?
Yes, and also it seems to me that in each chapter we try to emphasize a strong theoretical or methodological aspect in order to have the level of the discourse to be disentangled with the specificities of the field, and in order to be able to speak to a larger audience of course, of people related, of researcher focused on Japanese religions, but also a broader audience of people who are not necessarily working on Japanese religions, but can use certain themes that we analyze in the chapters for their field, for their researches. And it seems to me we also kept in mind this aspect.
Great, thank you. So now that we're sort of in the sort of topic of the terms and the concepts that I do feel like are really sort of central to this book, you know, some of the sort of words in there, you know, like sound, globalization, law, you know, these are things that you wouldn't necessarily directly relate to sort of religion at first glance. Can you sort of share how these group of terms sort of was decided, sort of whether you leave the selection to the contributors? Or is this sort of something that is predetermined from the start?
This has been this has evolved with the project, as you can imagine. A project of this size is more complicated than you look at the beginning. And we started with a structure that Fabio and I came up with a list of terms that we wanted to include and entries that we wanted to include related to some areas that we thought were developing and emerging and they were quite interesting of including. And then we added a new one through suggestion from the author. And then when Andrea came on board, he brought his suggestion too. And so the project evolving in this, and it's also important to probably note that there were other entries that at the end we were not able to include, mainly because we couldn't find people that could write about those topics. So we realized that it's probably one of the areas that still need a little bit more development. So I think we had initially some of the terms that we really wanted to include and then some other that evolve in discussion with the author. But also in when the handbook started shaping up, we realized that it would have been good to have some other entries. And then we contacted extra author later on in the process, asking them to write on specific topics. So I think, Fabio, Andrea, do you want to add anything on this?
That's pretty much it. It was a complicated process because, you know, identifying the topics. And again, we were looking at topics that we thought were understudied or could be studied in a different way or had some promise. We were also thinking about specific authors that we wanted to include. And again, we tried not to contact all the luminaries, but to contact a lot of emerging scholars. We contacted a lot of Japanese scholars who normally are not part of this kind of projects because, you know, they're more normally written by English-speaking scholars. So we did, you know, we played on different tables, you know, trying to put it together. And like Erica said, some entries we were not able to include, you know, like religion and sports, for example. And I think we have a short list in the introduction, you know, of some topics that, you know, could be included in a future handbook. So, but it was a lot of work. Andrea?
Yes. No, like Erika and Fabio have already said, it was, in my opinion, the overall is a complete selection. Although, of course, we had to leave something out because we couldn't find the people who could cover this topic. But the overall contributors that participated to the handbook, if you look at the names and the identities of the contributors, you can see it's a nice mix of Euro-American scholars, Asian scholars working together, and this is not a such a common phenomenon when in previous guides or handbooks on Japanese religions, when you have, I don't know, a priority, a majority of Japanese scholars, and then you have a different book and only Europeans or Americans without Asian scholars. But we try to have a diversity in the composition of the contributors of our handbook.
Yeah, I think it's important to stress at this point that we couldn't do this project without the contributors. So I think each of them brought in their expertise and produced these very interesting entries that the three of us wouldn't be able to do. So I think it's really important that we stress that this was really a collaborative endeavor and a project that was shaped also by the contributors themselves.
Absolutely, yeah. I don't think you can find as many sort of handbooks with sort of, you know, this many contributors and sort of these many different sort of ideas and sort of themes. I've noticed that there are several overlaps between some of the themes. For example, Yanis Gaitani's and sort of Horie Norichika's sort of sections on spirituality, and sort of Lindsay DeWitt and Yamanaka Hiroshi's sort of contributions on sort of cultural heritage. And I know that these are sort of very different sort of topics, and they're looking at it from sort of different perspective. But I was wondering if sort of these overlaps reflect perhaps a growing interest in sort of these topics, or sort of whether this is a way to sort of stress the importance of these particular topics.
I think both. There is a growing interest in those topics, and we were trying also to show the different articulation of those, the different approaches to those topics. So that's why there is some. The overlap is mostly in the title, by the way, because again, when you read the entries, you see that they're really going in different directions. But it's an attempt to highlight these intersections between Japanese religions and broader issues like, you know, spirituality or esotericism or a cultural heritage, as you suggested, that are, you know, normally not really or not directly related or not directly studied within religious studies of Japan until now. Yeah, you have also to put this, all this in context, right? When we study Japanese religions, at least in most places, you know, it's either Buddhism or more, you know, very rarely Shinto, and then you have some new religions. Some people may do something on Christianity, but it's mostly Buddhism from Buddhist texts. In this handbook, there's very little of that. So, of course, spirituality is a very important phenomenon in Japan, but very few people, you know, address it in a systematic way. So that's why we brought in several entries that, you know, would highlight the importance of this aspect for the study of the religiosity of Japan, not necessarily of established religious organizations. So that's why, you know, there are these kind of thematic clusters here and there in the book. The other one is aspects of sensoriality, for example. So you have sound, visuality, and all that. Cultural heritage is another emerging field that is very relevant for the study of religion, especially in the modern time. So we're trying to play on different tables, both with the topics, but also related to the current structure of academia and the structure of curricula for Japanese for the study of Japanese religions, and kind of scrambled, you know, the codes, so that we could promote new ideas and new approaches.
Certainly, yeah. Thank you. So sort of going back, sort of this idea of contributing something new to sort of our understanding of Japanese religions. I know that this is going to be a pretty difficult question, but let's say, you know, sort of, you know, maybe one of our listeners have no idea, have never heard about sort of Japanese religions. What are some of the ways that we can think about Japanese religions without sort of limiting ourselves to, you know, Buddhism or Shinto or sort of any other religious institutions?
Well, I think one good point with which we can start is, first of all, to emphasize the fractures instead of continuity. I think we analyze this aspect a little bit also in the introduction. So usually the standard narrative about Japanese religion is this never-ending perfect line proceeding without fractures, without breaks from the past to the present. But if you actually look at it, it's full of gaps, is full of ruptures, and in the recent time, I think we said this crisis, these breaks in the discourse happened at least three times. We had the 1995 sarin attack on the underground, that was a big turn. And then we have the Eastern Japan great earthquake of in 2011, March 11th. That was the second turn. And then now, for example, with the COVID-19, this might be the third big turn. So the third big fracture in the discourse, and all new religions as well as old religions reacted to this changes and adjust themselves. So, for example, if we look at this at this ruptures, at this fragmentation, at these gaps in the discourse, is a good trigger to deactivate certain common rhetoric about the nostalgia of the past that we always that they often found in the usual way to represent Japanese religions.
Yeah, I agree with Andrea. That is an excellent way to look at this. A point that I usually stress as being also someone working on the contemporary is to look at how religion is done, not necessarily how what religion is. So starting about looking at how religion is done in Japan. And this, I think, is what a lot of these entries also discuss. And then goes back also to your comment before about some of this topic not looking apparently related with religion. But if you start looking at how religion is done, they are fundamentally part of religion. Religious practice is always political. Religion is economic. So that looking at that is I think another very good way to start looking at and maybe understanding or at least trying to understand religion in contemporary Japan or in Japan in general. And I think this can be applied to the pre-modern period as well when you work on text, right, Fabio?
Yes, no, that's what I was going to say, that your considerations, both Andreas and yours, you know, can be applied to the pre-modern period as well. So religion is done, or religiosity, you know, is manifested in specific ways. And in the ways in which religion manifests itself or is done, there's very little space for like academic distinctions of sect, of lineage, of texts and all that. So I think it's very important to emphasize the situation on the field. And that would be, I think, the best approach to introduce students to the study of Japanese religion. I mean, see how it is done, how it looks like when you are in Japan. And then perhaps you may want to explore specific aspects, right? Why is this temple different from the other one? Why do these people do things in a certain way and these other groups do it in a different way? And then you can introduce issues of, you know, kind of historical lineages or continuities and so forth. This continuity and rupture, like Andrea said, are also very important in the pre-modern periods, of course, when you have these schismatic movements, you have these reform movements, you have rebellions and changes in doctrines and ways of thinking and practicing. So all of these, I think it's important. So maybe that's why, rather than a systematic, like, history of Shinto or history of Buddhism, perhaps having moments in which describing moments in which religion is done, takes place, is constituted on the ground, would be a better way and more like inclusive way to describe, to understand the situation.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, my own views have certainly changed sort of before coming to Japan and after being here in Japan, observing Japanese religions on the ground. So for the students and young scholars out there who are just getting into doing research in Japanese religion, what are some of the topics that are not covered in this volume, but you also think topics that are also important to pursue directions that people should take that are not perhaps, maybe there's not enough space to cover that in this volume?
Well, if I can start, just a few things that come to mind. One is cultural heritage, for example, which is mentioned in one entry. Maybe a couple of others make reference to it, but, this can be expanded in so many different ways. And cultural heritage, we tend to think of it as a very modern, very contemporary way of looking at the past. But a certain idea of cultural heritage has always been present. So when you see, like in the Edo period, when they go back to the Heian period, and try to reconstruct certain cultural practices. I mean, there was a certain idea of a cultural heritage that had to be preserved. So this goes, this kind of permeates the entire history of Japanese culture in general and religion in particular. Another aspect that is understudied is the sensorium, the role of food, the role of sound, smell, and all of these kind of bodily, direct bodily interactions with the sacred. Again, we have a couple of entries there, but of course, this is such a vast field that needs to be, can be expanded in many, many directions. Tourism is also another thing that seems to be unrelated to religion, but in fact it is, because you need to bring pilgrims, you need to bring people to the temple. So something that is very fascinating to me is the role of railways or public transportation for the development of religious sites. And of course, in the modern time, that is crucial, but also in pre-modern times, temples needed access routes, right? So they needed roads, they needed ways to get there. And that, I think, has not been studied in depth, as far as I know. I mean, this connection between the temples and their own access. And the other, and another aspect, which I think is very, very important also, is the environmental impact of religious institutions. Like when you have Mount Ye with 10,000 people living there on the mountain, what was the impact on the environment? What did they do? What did they do with trash, for example? How did they procure food? What were the channels of logistics that enabled this mountain to not only to survive, but prosper as well? So these are all implications that, they go beyond religion, but involve economics, again, transportation, logistics, and all that. But that's, I think, an important way to understand how religion could be created and maintained in Japan.
We listed some of the possible topic for further research at the end of our in our introduction, and some of the topic that Fabio mentioned, and I just want to mention a couple of other that he mentioned: a sensorial experience, but I think the emotional one as well. So aesthetics in the broader sense is something that needs to be explored more. Another point that we made is the idea of a religion in the periphery. So a lot of study tend also, when we look at the contemporary, to be focused on the main center, Kyoto Nara region or in contemporary Tokyo, so the main urban center, but a lot can be done also more in the periphery. And the other point was the environmental aspect that the Fabio mentioned, but also the relationship with non-human beings, so like animals, for example, that there has been some study done, but I think there is one of the area that a lot more could be done. And of course, the technology is one of the area that is continuously evolving with the new technology. So there is a continuous in an area that is continually changing, and new challenges appear through that, also in terms of memorialization of ancestor, etc. Andrea, do you have any other of the new areas
Yeah, new areas, even for me, we mentioned in the introduction, geospatiality of religion, there is a tendency to emphasize the landscape of the mountains, the landscape of the rice field in connection with Japanese religions. But what about the sea? Fabio has done work in that direction, but there is more. And going back to what you were saying, Erika, also physicality, body, and animality. If we embrace, for example, the sea, but in this case also the mountains, what is the relationship between the animals of the sea, the animals of the mountain, and the production of religious discourses in pre-modern or modern Japan? And also another thing that we mentioned in the introduction is the multilingual aspects of Japanese religions. For example, in the researches connected with Japanese Buddhism, there is an emphasis on, for example, classical Chinese, but Japanese Buddhism was and is based not only on classical Chinese, but also on Sanskrit letter, for example, Japanese written composition, like the ritual use of the waka or the poems. So it's a mixed language with them, which that are bringing together different sensibilities coming from within Japan as well as from outside Japan. So these are fields that can be explored more probably in the future years.
Yeah, if I may add just something by way of footnote, is that, you know, some of these fields that we have been discussing here had already been approached like 50, 60, 70 years ago. I'm thinking about aesthetics, for example, you know. But the way in which aesthetics was approached in the past was that, you know, the aristocracy likes these elaborate lavish rituals, you know, that have nothing to do with the people and the true authentic expression of religiosity. So that was a way to get rid of all that. And for decades, nobody ever approached it because the topic itself had been so compromised by this particular approach. So it is really important to also think about how past scholars have addressed some of these particular issues and come to them from a very different angle. So like the role of the body, for example, or, you know, whatever, what we have been discussing here. So what I'm saying is that some of these topics have already been studied, but in a very, let's say, partial or slanted or kind of denigratory way that also needs to be, you know, we have to be aware of that and overcome that and, you know, looking for new explanations and new meaning.
Definitely, yeah. Thank you so much. So in sort of the introduction, there is a short section on COVID-19, and I was sort of wondering if you could share some of your thoughts on sort of how the pandemic have, or if it could change the way we think about religions or how we study them.
If I can start, where as someone working on a contemporary issue, it's always very difficult to discuss something or to make comments or something that is happening. So I think we will need a few years to judge the impact of the pandemic on practice. And of course, we have a lot of experience in a lot of examples through history of religion bouncing back from pandemic and disaster and crisis. So this is by no means a unique event. But we wanted to add these kind of comments at the end of the introduction because it was impossible not to comment on it when we were finishing the handbook, the pandemic. We were on lockdown, the pandemic has just started. And what we noticed was, of course, already changes in the practice in the immediate, so how groups reacted to the impossibility of meeting in person, and comparing to other recent disasters, as the Tripoli disaster in 2011, the main difference was that the volunteers couldn't be employed, that the people couldn't meet, which is in person, which is an important aspect of religious practice. So different groups came up with different ideas to maintain contact with the members or to make the rituals available, and it's a bit different, innovative, but it's also important to remember that some didn't at all because they weren't prepared for doing it. So there's been a very different degrees of innovation that we're seeing with the pandemic. Another aspect I was particularly interested in is how the pandemic had impacted deprived group in Japanese society and the religion organization working with them, so how they could help people where they had to protect them and their own volunteers. So this has been one of the area I've been quite interested in, together with the economic impact on temples of the pandemic that has been quite significant. So those aspects, I think we will need a little bit more time to fully understand the impact, but it's quite interesting to see the different reaction and also the different response to the pandemic. I think Fabio, and I'm sure Fabio and Andrea have other comments on this.
Fabio, should I go first?
And then... go ahead. Yeah, please.
Yeah, okay. Just an idea. For example, the impact of COVID-19 on Kagura performances, most of them were performed the same during the pandemic, but they were just performed by the specialist without the audience. But after the performance, during the performance of the Kagura, of the sacred dances for the kami, the performance was recorded, and very often it was put on YouTube to be watched by the people after the event. This had, for example, a strong impact on the fact that certain Kagura, not all the Kagura, but certain Kagura also have a secret part, so also are strongly related with secrecy. So, if something is supposed to be secret and then you upload it on YouTube on an open link, then the emphasis on the secrecy fade away, and you have a different kind of reframing of the religious performance of the Kagura. So there's an impact, and it will be, as Erika was saying, it will be interesting to see how after the COVID-19 these changes will remain or will go away or new phenomenon will appear. It will be nice to research on the impact of the COVID-19 on the long durée of this kind of religious phenomena like Kagura and so on, or virtual talismans made by the temples and so on.
Just to continue with what Andrea just said, so this year in April, I was watching on YouTube the live streaming of Shoryoe at Shitennoji. You know, Shoryoe is one of the oldest ceremonies ever performed in Japan, you know, dedicated to Shotoku Taishi. And so the temple decided not to have a live audience, but to perform the Bugaku ritual. And so it was live on YouTube. So normally the space of Shitennoji is full when this performance takes place live. So I was expecting like dozens of thousands of people, you know, watching on YouTube. I think there were like 200 of us or 300. It was like a tiny amount. So, and that was kind of counterintuitive to me, because I thought, well, being online, everybody can watch it. A lot of people would watch it, and they didn't. So this brings up first of all, the actual relevance of social media and the digital technologies for religion. And the second one is that if people don't care that much, you know, what is going to happen to these rituals in the future if it's only like a small group of people who do them and the others don't really care unless it's a special social event that involves other aspects, you know, like the Shoryue, it's not just for the Bugaku, obviously, you know, there are a lot of components that are part of it together with the Kagura, right? It's the whole Matsuri, the whole thing that makes sense. So these are all considerations that, you know, came up, but of course we don't have an answer now. Something that was interesting to me during the lockdown in particular is really, I think we even wrote it at the, you know, on the introduction, is really the, you know, thinking about the end of times, because this is what religion has always been doing in a way or another. They all, you know, religion also serves to reinforce the present, you know, but there's always this component, you know, thinking about what happens, death, you know, with the end, you know, individual death or cosmic death. And I've seen that in disasters movies during this time, that many of them have increased and present a very bleak image of the future. I haven't seen that dealt much in terms of religious organizations, but I wonder if, you know, it is, I wonder if this could be a possible development within the religious discourse, also in terms of like climate change, you know, huge transformations that we are facing and all the dangers that we are facing, you know, for the next couple of generations, if religious organizations will also begin to address earnestly, you know, the topic of the end of times.
If I can briefly add to what Fabio Andrea was saying, I think that, you know, the beginning we had this frenzies of in a sense, wanting to go online and to make everything available. And there was kind of also, not just in for the religion organization, but also in our personal life, to try to be connected in any way, quite a kind of excitement. And then we went into the Zoom burnout, where we, you know, less and less people actually participate to this online event. And also because in different parts of the world, we are different stage in the pandemic. So that also, we are shared experience, but it's actually not in the same, not exactly in the same way. So it will be interesting that, like Andrea was saying, to see the long-term impact about if this technology were just useful for a brief amount of moment, or some of them will stay. I want to reiterate also that what is also implied of it is economic impact. Because if you move your ritual online and you don't have people coming to the temple, it will have a potentially a kind of significant economic impact on your revenue. And this is something that, you know, it has to be taken into consideration and will impact on the long-term availability of these online free performances. So these are also aspects that we are going to see more in this other phase of the pandemic, I think.
Yeah, certainly. These are sort of fascinating examples. I guess in the end, it's sort of up to us researchers to just sort of keep an eye on sort of these changes and these developments. But we've taken much of your time today. So before we sort of say goodbye, there is one final question. Can you tell me what projects you're currently working at?
Something I'm working again on something on marine hybrid creatures, something on Ningyo Amabie. Amabie is also a marine creature that we mentioned in the introduction, that was used as a talisman against COVID-19 last year, and even this year, apparently the flame is going on a little. So I'm working on that this moment. And my standard topic, Yudono Shugendo and the cult of that mountain, the Edo people. Fabio, It's your turn.
Okay. I mentioned that at the introduction. I'm working on the intersection of religion and music with special focus on Gagaku. I see that as a continuation of my work on materiality because, we're dealing with ritual implements, musical instruments. But, of course, there is an immaterial component, which is sound, which, again, is part of the sensorium of religion. Gagaku is normally not understood in religious terms, but it was an important part. It's been, for many centuries, actually, an important part of the most important religious ceremonies, both in Shinto shrines and at Buddhist temples, in addition to the imperial court. So I'm trying to explore this kind of complex phenomenon beyond, musicology, more a kind of a social history of the role of sound. And so basically the soundscape of Japanese religion.
And I just finished a project on aesthetics and emotion of religious belonging. There is a coming up special issue for Newman, and we look at example on from the Buddhist world, not just from Japan, but from other East Asian contexts as well. And I'm now working on a project with two colleagues in Bergen in Norway on minority and religion that is also part of a project with Professor Takahashi at the Toyo University, so we are working on a special issue with him on minority and religious minorities in Japan. And the project with colleagues in Bergen is going to be an open access database with different articles on minority and religions. So these are the two main projects I'm working on. And at the moment, I'm mainly hoping to be able to go to Japan soon to do some proper field work.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Yeah, well, I certainly look forward to sort of, keeping up to date with sort of these projects and maybe we can sort of, see each other again in the future. Thank you.